It's a big deal since Portland funds about 80% of their budget. The why from Portland's end seems to be twofold. One aspect is the overhaul of Portland's city government structure that's set to be complete by January 2025. Ryan says they plan to create a city arts office instead of relying on the regional arts body. The second reason stems from last winter, when city commissioners refused to accept the financial reporting from RAC, alleging they were misspending taxpayer dollars. It's not over till it's over, though, and RAC is hosting a number of community outreach forums to educate people and push back on the Portland decision. I spoke with Regional Arts and Culture Council Executive Director Carol Tatch to learn more. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. For a little bit of table setting, what is RAC?
Okay, so RAC is a wonderful organization. We are a nonprofit. We sit in the Portland metro area, so the Tri-County area, and we are an arts services agency for the region. We are a regional arts and culture council. We primarily do our work through an intergovernmental agreement with Multnomah County, Clackamas County, Washington County, Metro, and the City of Portland. And we have been doing this for 28 years. RAC was formed out of the Metropolitan Arts Commission as a community-led organization to support artists, creatives, and the arts landscape here in the region in 1995.
So the most recent news about RAC is that Portland says that they will be canceling their contract with the Arts and Culture Council. What does that mean for the organization?
Well, for RAC, it means because a significant portion of the our work is in the city of Portland, about 80%. Comes through the contract supporting our operations here, which include grant making, our public art program. We are the public art stewards for the City of Portland and Multnomah County, as well as that funding that goes out to individual artists and creatives and organizations. And so what that means is RAC will no longer be the organization that does that. And, you know, caught up in that space are the ancillary programs that we also support the community with technical assistance, professional development workshops. Folks have the opportunity folks who are applying for grants or public art award opportunities have a chance to call in to get support before submitting their grants. We're also available if an applicant is unsuccessful to help them understand what they need to do to make their application better the next time around. So it's really a wraparound service, and that's what will be lost. Since community created RAC as that entity to be that interface with governments, all of the local governments, and getting that money out into community, that link will be lost, and everything will now go back into the government portal. And I say go back into, this has not been a state that the region has been in for 50 years, because prior to the creation of the Regional Arts and Culture Council was the Metropolitan Arts Commission. Again, it was a joint community-wide engagement, but set in the government space. So it's really going back 50 years into a space where no one will have access, there won't be public access to making decision-making about where the arts and culture dollars are going. And last year, we distributed over $8 million just for the city of Portland. And through our contracts, and so that will be lost. That's a lot of money that we will no longer have access to being, that the community will no longer have access to understanding how it's being distributed.
What is the expected impact on artists and community spaces?
Well, there right now, it's, you know, there's fear, primarily because of the reputation RAC has had over these 3 decades to be that communicator, to be that link, to bring in community voice and understanding in our processes and everything we do. Even the grants that we get out through our grants program, as well as the awards that we give out through our public art program, are administered by our community reviewers. So it is community leaning into what it needs in this space and making those decisions. So that will be lost. There won't be that community voice, and there won't be that access to really understand what's needed in this space. We want folks to be able to always have a voice in what we see and engage with as we go through our daily lives.
What has been the community response to this news?
It has been, it's run the gamut. So a lot of sadness, a lot of concern, a whole lot of concern, not only for the opportunities that may be lost. One of the things that RAC has brought into the space is an equity view in how the dollars are distributed. And there's a very real fear that it will go back to a space where only the larger organizations are receiving funding. And one of the things RAC has been very dedicated to doing is ensuring that the dollars are spread equitably into small and large, medium-sized and large organizations. And so that sits as a present fear. There's also a fear around whether or not the all of the ancillary programs that RAC has to support our creatives will not be available in the government space. So again, the technical assistance, the workshops, the ability to call in and say, what happened? How can I make this better? Can you help me write my application? All of those, you know, sit in a space where the community is like, we don't know. We really don't know what to do then, because they've not known anything different, I would say, especially in these last 28 years. And we sit in a space where, for the organization, since that is a large part of our funding, we want to be here. Our plan is to remain here as a regional arts service agency, because we do have four other contracts through that intergovernmental agreement. And we want to be able to fulfill those contracts, as well as think about what other opportunities we need to lean into to support a community that won't have what it had before. So we are repositioning ourselves to be able to answer questions now, to think about how we need to reframe our work, to be able to reach out in a more defined way. And since we are a nonprofit that, you know, has as its mission and vision to continue serving the arts and culture landscape, what does it look like to change in that space? We're asking community members specifically, what do you need right now? What do you think you will need if this change goes through? How can RAC be here for you? As well as letting them know what we are doing in this process of reevaluating how we can remain a vibrant and thriving organization with the loss of so much of support through that one contract. We have started we've initiated a series of community meetings. We have had our first one, and we will have more coming through in the next few weeks that we are posting, so that community can actually come in and talk with us, and we can be first and foremost in a space where we can just be together. Then we lift up the opportunities that we are looking into, and we reach out to community primarily to say that this is not a done deal. You can still react. We are providing opportunities for that action, including how to respond to City Council. And my ask in that space is to understand that since this will have a regional impact. We have artists who live in our counties who primarily work in the city of Portland who will not get funding. Dan Ryan has let us know that at this point they are not looking at the Portland dollars going outside of the region. That will be a significant hit for our artists and creative communities, as well as our organizations who don't see those, you know, those defined boundaries of Portland versus Beaverton versus Gresham versus Hillsborough versus Estacada versus Tigard. And so it's kind of put us in a, you know, the community in a stir, and RAC in a place where we are dedicated to working towards a solution. We want to be there. We know we are, you know, for 28 years we've done this. We are the experts in the work that we do across the board. Our public art team is award-winning for what it does. Our grant-making program is seen as a beacon and an icon for other funding organizations because of the way that we're able to fund and get the dollars out as efficiently and effectively as we have been able to.
Well, to some of those reasons that Dan Ryan and Portland have said that they will not be renewing the contract, how do you respond to critiques from Portland City Council about what they say is a lack of transparency and too much spending on administration?
Yeah, we act from a place of curiosity. For instance, and we have already put this out in our FAQs, which people can find on our website. We do hope that folks will check out our advocacy hub on the RAC website. But to the allegation that RAC is spending 50% of the dollars that we get from the city on admin and internally, and actually that number is 12.5%. across all of our contracts, we do not exceed 17.5%, which is actually on the low side for any government contracts. It usually ranges between 18 and 21 to 25%. So with 12.5% admin, we do not understand why they are saying 50. There's no way that the math maths out to that. And the city, of course, receives our reports on a quarterly basis. These are open to the public, so the public has a space to actually go in and look and see for themselves. So it's disinformation, and we are trying to rebut that with real information. As for lack of transparency, you know, having just mentioned that we do routine reports, regular reports to the city, we also make presentations. All of the work that we do through our government contracts is public access. So the transparency has to be there. That's the only way we can actually continue to be successful in meeting the metrics of our contract with the city and with our counties.
What do you wish people knew about RAC?
Wow, I think what I wish people knew, and this would be in the general public space, is the width and breadth of the work that we do and that we've done for 28 years. We are really woven into the fabric of community. You walk out of your door and you see art on the street if you're walking in Portland or Multnomah County, that's RAC. When you walk into the Multnomah County Central Courthouse, the incredible transformation that has happened there, where that space does not look like a trauma creating space. It has incredible artwork, and incredible creatives have leaned into making that space as welcoming as possible. That's RAC. The grants that go out to fund community events, both small and large, and artists to be able to keep being active. Our work in our arts education program to lift up inequities in arts education. Our advocacy work at the local, state, and national levels. We are in those spaces. We speak with Congresswoman Bonamici. We speak with Representative Rob Nose. We walk to the streets in Salem for the Cultural Advocacy Day. It's part of our work. We are here to make sure that the Portland metro region, and indeed the Pacific Northwest, has what it needs to ensure that our community can thrive. And that's what I would want community to know. That will be what will be lost if RAC is not able to do its work. We have nearly three decades of trust and engagement with community, and that will go behind a government door that no one will be able to get behind. No one will have the transparency of knowing where the dollars are going, and no one will really have a voice, and that's our piece, since we were created by community, for community. Community is how we do our work, and that community voice will be lost.
What is your ask of people right now?
To protest, to say no, to go before council and say and speak to their truths, those artists and creatives who know the value of our work, the community reviewers who know the value of their work in helping us be able to make sure our community is funded and strong. To think about how art and culture has engaged with them over their lifetimes and what could be lost in that process, and to contact us. We are welcome. We are here to be an open door for how folks can lift their voices up. We've had several artists start their own campaigns. We are in the spaces where now with our community engagements, we are asking, what would you like us to do? And we want to be in a space where we are always accessible. We want the community to be able to continue to thrive, and our feeling, our steadfast feeling, is that can only happen if RAC remains the organization that it is, with the funding from the city, since that is so critical to our whole landscape.
Well, what can you tell me about your upcoming events?
Yes, we have had our first one at Open House on MLK, on Northeast MLK in Portland. Our next one is happening at Body Vox, following that one, and we have just a series of opportunities for folks to be able to engage. We intentionally made them region-wide. They're in the city of Portland, they're outside the city of Portland, they're in Washington and Multnomah County, throughout Multnomah County, in Washington County, and in Clackamas County. Please come to these spaces. We want to hear from you. We want to hear the concerns. We want to lift up the opportunities, and we want to talk about how we build a stronger RAC, irregardless of the work with the city. We are always looking for ways for community to engage with us to let us know what is needed. So we will keep, through our social media, we will keep everyone updated on how they can come to the events. If, you know, outside of an event, we want people to know they can contact us. I'm happy to sit on the phone or through a Zoom call to talk with anyone who has specific questions. And that's an important aspect as well. Part of the engagement we're going to be doing will be virtual. We understand that not everybody can make it to these venues where we're having the events. So we want to be able to gather even in the virtual space. So those will be included in the opportunities for community.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, I do. I want to say that we are working really to understand how best to continue our role and support our intergovernmental agreements with Metro, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. We want to applaud the effort on Governor Kotek's behalf and the Oregon Business Council Task Force to come in and try to see how we can actually make Portland the space that it needs to be. And we want to be part of the solution. We want to be here for our community, engage with community, supporting community.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Althea.
That was Carol Tatch, the Executive Director of the Regional Arts and Culture Council. Their upcoming events are on Wednesday, September 20th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Body Vox, 1201 Northwest 17th in Portland, and another event on Monday, September 25th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Lakewood Center for the Arts, 368 South State Street in Lake Oswego. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings. This is KBOO News in Depth. Some critics of U.S. foreign policy say that since the 9/11 terrorist attacks, there has been very little critical reporting on what our country is actually doing around the world. They say that many mainstream media reports read like a kind of perpetual war propaganda. Colleen Rowley is a former FBI agent and whistleblower who, in May of 2002, wrote a memo to then-FBI Director Robert Mueller exposing some of the FBI's conduct prior to 9/11. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about what she thinks happened to critical reporting since then.
You have noticed that there's a kind of relentless propaganda war, promoting war. Could you explain that? How could that be when we have a free media that is supposed to report critically on U.S. foreign policy?
You know, we maybe had some critical reporting back during the Vietnam War with Seymour Hersh, but just looking at the career of Seymour Hersh is a window into what's happened. You know, here he won prizes, Pulitzer Prizes, etc., back in the day when we had investigative reporting, the I.F. Stone type of thing. Then, after 9/11, the 9/11 attacks, quote unquote, changed everything. And when they say changed everything, it did. I mean, it's on so many levels that it did change everything. It launched the war on terror. It increased the national spending deficit by, I'm thinking now it's like 7-8 times what it was at 9/11, and it's just going up. It very much changed the way media communications occur. And after 9/11, you heard this very boast, this kind of a boast. We can make our own reality. We don't have to worry. You know, of course, Seymour Hersh and the old guard of investigative journalists, they were trying to report reality. That's what was always considered to be the goal of journalism. That's how it serves as a check on abuses, government abuses, corporate abuses, etc. That's how it serves basically to maintain democracy. It cannot maintain democracy if the people in the top power level claim that they can make their own reality.
And if they mostly for foreign policy, though? And would you say that some of the reporting on domestic policy is a little better?
You know, actually, I think it's on all levels. But yes, I think it's worse on foreign policy. And the reason it's probably worse on foreign policy is because it's easier to do. It's easier to manipulate people when you have a foreign enemy. So you just dehumanize. You know, it's the old thing about making war. There's almost a formula for how to make war, how to come up with the pretext for war. You can look through all history and see this. But that's relatively easier to do with a domestic group. But I will say that the investigative reporting, all of your big corporate, you know, big pharma, and I mean, essentially all across the board, they also have a lot of power over the media now. And you very rarely will see a whistleblower, even on a domestic issue like Karen Silkwood, or who's the one that found out the water was tainted in the wells? I forget her name now. Erin Brockovich, Frank Serpico, they were all domestic whistleblowers. And I don't think you even will see many news reports of honest, truthful insider whistleblowing, even on domestic issues. But it's far worse on foreign policy.
Is some of that because of the budget cuts that at least newspapers have gone through, that they've kind of gotten rid of their investigative divisions and some of their foreign correspondents? They don't have people on the ground necessarily, and that's been taken over by broadcast media?
Yes, I do think that plays a role. They had to cut their foreign correspondents, and absolutely, that actually does make it even easier, because all they do is the media, which are kind of owned by, what is it, six? They're co-owned by the six big ones, or five or six big ones. And you see that they run the same talking points. And yes, they've had to make budget cuts, cut their foreign correspondents. It means that reporters do it the easy way. They don't have the time to devote because there's not enough of them. So the easy way is to develop sources, insider sources in government. And the sources in government, of course, are just basically going to hand them a press release and or, you know, quote unquote, leak them a story. And you also, the result is that you see all of the different media with hardly any differences. They all have the same talking points. And it'll even be almost the same wording in big stories. If you flip channels, you will see the same thing being said on every channel sometimes. And it's not because they all called each other up in the morning and decided to say it this way. A lot of it is due to the budget cuts, but there's a little more than that going on. It's also the fact that the people in power were very proud of gaining control of the mainstream media. And then after they accomplished that feat, they've gone on to try to control the electronic media and the social media, which is what Matt Taibbi and other reporters have revealed through different emails with Twitter and other social media. So it's coming out that basically it's basically McCarthyism even on the electronic media now. But it did start with this mainstream media. And if you are a Seymour Hersh, you know, he's lived long enough to have gone full circle from the time when he was heralded and awarded top prizes for his investigative reporting to the situation now where he's considered a pariah. I mean, it's quite an amazing thing. He's not, I just use him as an example, but there's many other really, I would say, honest, decent journalism. They went into journalism because they thought it would, they believed in the old ethos, and it's all been corrupted. I used to teach ethics, law enforcement ethics, and one of the points in law enforcement ethics, all ethics, is that when you have a cheating or some kind of abuse starts, and it becomes then normalized, when that type of, like I said, shortcuts in stories, when that becomes normalized, then nobody even feels bad about doing it anymore. At least you would have, if you were plagiarizing or whatever, you at least have a little guilty conscience if you're the only one. But right now, I think this type of corruption of mainstream, of all media, has basically become normalized. So if you're in that environment, you don't even know that anything you're doing is wrong. If you have a government source that gives you a false story, I mean, let's use the example of Scooter Libby leaking to about the aluminum tubes on Iraq. Now, this goes all the way back to, you know, shortly after 9/11. And, you know, it was found out it's a false story. But you know what? There was no accountability ever for that story. And again, this is taken as the cue. If you do this and not, there's no ramifications for it, and everyone else is doing it this way, as a reporter, you're going to do the same thing.
But then, especially in this age, you've got the internet. People can go look at Al Jazeera or RT or Agence France-Presse or any number of other online publications, or you could watch Democracy Now! Or The Young Turks or Glenn Greenwald's podcast. But would you say that that takes a little too much trouble for most people?
Well, it is very time-consuming to actually assess the facts. So if you're an individual and you are trying to really figure out what is true and what is not true, you do have to do it, what you just mentioned. You have to watch and listen to a variety of sources. And so if it's foreign policy, for instance, you may not take it for granted that every word out of, you know, one of the foreign news reporting agencies is true. But if you look at enough of them, you can put it all together. So, for instance, you know, Russia Today and Press TV, quite a number of foreign news sources have been banned. They've been banned in the United States and in the NATO member countries for the most part. So they're rather hard to find. So if you want to see the take that Russia Today is putting out, and you don't have to buy it, you don't have to totally believe in every word they say, but it's helpful because they're not suffering from the same bias as Western-based news reporting. But they're very hard to find. Russia Today is hard to find.
You can get it online, although the stories will be like a day old, but I think you can still get it.
Yeah, that's right. You can find some of the, you know, people ask me all the time, Colleen, I have no way of knowing what is true or not true anymore. And I don't have the time to do what you're doing. I'm retired, so I do have more time to try to read and listen to a variety of sources from different perspectives, but most people don't have that time. And then, of course, you say, well, after a while, you can look at a track record of a news reporting. Let's say Greenwald, for instance. You know what? He's been right a lot. You know, all of the Snowden reporting and whatever. So you can then gain a measure of trust in certain sources if you know their track record. So there's little tricks to doing this when you're trying to look at a variety of sources, but you have to do that now. If you really want to know the facts of something, you cannot watch your nightly TV news, because I'm here to say that almost all of it is propaganda. There's spins, they call it a spin. That seems like a softer way than saying propaganda, but it's all spin and it's all manipulative. They use those after 9/11, see, that's where 9/11 changed everything. They found out they really could use fear. There was a whole book written called The Shock Doctrine. So The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, which I think she's right about this. When you have traumatized people, they are going to tend to become more obedient to authority and to manipulation from authoritarian sources. And so there's always this constant repeat of scaring people. And then, of course, you can also use hatred and pride. There's other, what we always thought of as human vulnerabilities. We thought of these actually as vices: fear, hate, greed, false pride, and blind loyalty. We always thought of these as bad things, but they're used over and over by people who are schooled in how to do propaganda, you know, since Edward Bernays made up the science of propagandizing. And in order to get around that, you have to really be able to look at a variety of sources with different perspectives.
Although I have noticed that if you read some of the mainstream newspaper articles, you can get a lot of good information, and sometimes buried in the middle or the end of those articles is some what you might call more truthful information, but I don't know if people have the patience necessarily to read those whole articles.
That's exactly right. If you remember before the Iraq War, there was one reporter at the Washington Post, Walter Pincus, and he was the only one providing the mostly truthful facts, but he was buried on page 19. They never put him up front. And so how many people make it to page 19 of the Washington Post? And so that's exactly how they do it. And even individual stories, they want to claim that they're giving you the honest, this helps their conscience, by the way, if they can throw something in there so that later on they can say, well, we didn't say that. You know, we also put this in, you know, he said, she said. And so if you read, but you know what, this type of reading skill that you probably have, this is called cognitive reading. And it's tested on your, when you go to college, they give you these tests, college entrance tests. A lot of the college entrance tests test you on your cognitive reading skill. And you know what? People these days don't score that high in it. You know, if you got a perfect on your cognitive reading, then maybe, yes, you can figure some of these things out. But most people do not have that kind of incisive reading skill.
That's former FBI agent and whistleblower Colleen Rowley speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. This has been KABU News In Depth. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KABU's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kabu.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KABU is an equal opportunity employer.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Stories I've Told the Stars, Friday, September 22nd, from